From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Does healthcare reform face an endless summer? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Barack Obama is staking his first term as president on achieving health care reform. Republicans are dragging their heels, and Democrats are divided. At tonight's primetime news conference, the White House says the president will address the questions Americans want answered. On To the Point, we'll address the political and economic realities that will still be there in the morning. What are the hardest choices that will have to be made? What are the special interest lobbyists up to? What if there's no bill by the congressional recess in August? On Reporter's Notebook Letter on DNA testing and Major League Baseball. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. President Obama is pulling out all the stops to get health care reform, including a news conference tonight in prime time. What challenges will he still face when he continues his campaign tomorrow? We'll look at that. On Reporter's Notebook, genetic testing of employees by employers will become illegal in the U.S. this coming November. What will that mean for Major League Baseball? First, this news update. Gun control advocates won a rare victory today in the U.S. Senate, but not by much. An amendment to the defense spending bill failed on a vote of 58-39, just two votes short of the 60 it needed. The issue was permits to carry concealed weapons. Martin Cady is deputy congressional editor for Politico.com. Martin, good to have you on our program.
Oh, thank you.
What would this have allowed had it passed?
This would have allowed anyone who has a conceal and carry permit to cross state lines legally with that gun concealed and be within the law, as long as the state you're going to also has a conceal and carry law. There's only two states that do not. I believe they're Illinois and Wisconsin. So the Republicans and the Democrats who proposed this called this a reciprocity law, you know, something akin to, my Virginia driver's license is just as good in California if I'm driving in California. But it was a very close vote. They got a lot of Democrats on this, but it did go down. The folks who helped kill it thought that it was just a step too far. It was a rare defeat for the NRA lobby.
Now, the people in favor of it called it reciprocity. Those against it said it might be a violation of states' rights.
Well, that's right, because, for the most part, historically, gun laws have been written by states. I mean, New York and South Carolina and California all have very different laws, rules on who can and can't get a conceal and carry permit. And it was interesting to hear Democrats say that this was a violation of states' rights. But, the argument won the day, but still about 20 Democrats did vote yes. Most of them were from the South and from the Midwest, places where, people care a lot more about their conceal and carry permits.
New York Democrat Charles Schumer said this was a most dangerous piece of legislation. Dianne Feinstein of California said it might have deadly consequences, both of them from states that have tough concealed weapons laws.
Yeah, and their primary concern, especially the New York Democrats, the California Democrats, was that they have a much higher standard for who can get a conceal and carry. It takes a lot longer to get one in California or in New York, and it's a lot easier, say, in Florida or even in Virginia, where I live. And they didn't want someone who was, crossing the state border who would never qualify for a concealed weapons permit, say, in New York, to go from a state that gives them out a lot more freely. So they were saying, don't bring your gun permits from your state into our state. And it was also interesting that this would have federalized the concept of conceal and carry on some level, and that's what a lot of Democrats and even a couple Republicans were afraid of.
Is the NRA hopeful to get that ultimately?
I'm sure they're always hopeful to get that. The fact that this got nearly 20 Democrats in the Senate, in a Senate that is controlled 60-40 by Democrats. I mean, the NRA will not give up on this, and it's a rare defeat. But I remember, I think the last time you and I talked a few months ago was when the Senate did approve a gun amendment that would have that basically overturned the District of Columbia's very strict gun laws. So this was maybe just one step too far, even for people that are in favor of Second Amendment rights, believe that people should own a gun. They thought this sort of nationalization of the conceal and carry laws went just one step too far.
I think we talked at that point, too, about Congress voting this year to restoring the rights of people to carry loaded weapons into national parks not affected by state laws. Two Republicans voted against this one today, George Voinovich of Ohio, Dick Lugar of Indiana. Is that a surprise?
I was slightly surprised. I mean, Voinovich, these are both moderates, and Voinovich is retiring, so he doesn't really have any political consequences. And Lugar is a noted moderate on this. I didn't hear his reasoning for it, but I did hear him on the Senate floor say no. I can assume that that some of the arguments that he may have made and that some moderate Republicans made was that, look, we're in favor of Second Amendment rights, but we don't think that one state should have to honor another state's gun laws, especially when there's great disparities between how strict they might be and who they give out these conceal and carry permits to.
Harry Reid, the majority leader in the Senate from Nevada, of course, voted for it. He's up for re-election next year.
Sure, and Harry Reid is the number one target for the Republicans next year. They believe that he will be weak in Nevada. It's 2010 is going to be a year where Republicans are expected to make gains after two big Democratic sweeps in the last two elections. Nevada is a very pro-gun state, and, you know, Reid is not very popular in Nevada. So this gave him a free chance to say, hey, I'm on the right side of the gun owners, but also he didn't have to deal with the actual policy consequences, because this did fall short. But you know, we expected him to do this. He allowed this vote to happen. He's the majority leader. He controls the schedule, so he allowed this to happen. And I guess it gave a few Democrats a chance to get right with the gun lobby, but it fell just short. But if it comes up again, you know, we'll see.
You wonder if the real point is the issue itself or the effort to pick off Democrats in conservative districts. We don't have time to speculate on that, but Martin Cady, it's good to have you on our program. Thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.
Deputy Congressional Editor for Politico.com. That's a political news website based in Washington. In a moment, does health care reform face an endless summer? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. With just 2 weeks until Congress leaves town for the August recess, President Obama is pushing hard for health care reform. Tonight, he'll address the issue at a news conference in prime time. Yesterday, he had an upbeat assessment of progress.
I know that there is a tendency in Washington to accentuate the differences instead of underscoring common ground. But make no mistake, we are closer than ever before to the reform that the American people need, and we're going to get the job done.
Karen Tumulty is national political correspondent for Time magazine. She's written extensively about this. And, Karen, it's always good to have you on our program.
Thanks a lot, Warren.
With all due respect to the president, let's get back to some of the differences here that may raise a problem. Does he still have a deadline of getting both houses to pass a bill before they go off on recess?
You know, it's going to be really interesting to hear what he has to say about that tonight, because the fact is Congress, if you talk to anybody privately in the leadership offices, they are not going to meet that deadline. At this point, Henry Waxman's committee in the House was supposed to be passing out its bill tonight. Instead, they've had to suspend their deliberations for the last 2 days because Waxman's trying to work out a deal with his own conservative Democrats. And over on the Senate side, Max Baucus, the Senate Finance Committee chairman, is meeting behind closed doors with Republicans. But no one is expecting to see a work product out of them until, you know, early next week at the earliest. So the flat-out truth is they're not going to make that August deadline, and that's a very dangerous development.
What kind of problems is Waxman encountering with his Democratic colleagues in the House?
Well, here's the situation. The bills that have been passed so far that have come out of one committee in the Senate and two committees in the House have been criticized, and not just by Republicans and not just by partisans, but by some outside experts, and including the Congressional Budget Office and the Mayo Clinic, which the president cites as an example of what healthcare ought to look like, they've been criticized because while these bills do a very good job of expanding coverage, of making sure that most of those 47 million Americans who don't have coverage now would get it, what they really don't do enough of is transform the healthcare system and get these spiraling costs under control.
What about the Republicans? What are they saying?
Well, the Republicans have really sort of, I think, coalesced this week behind a message. They are essentially warning the American people that this is dangerous. The word you hear from their lips most often is experiment. That must have tested well in front of somebody's focus group, because it's the word you hear. Basically, they are trying to argue that for whatever our healthcare system's problems are, that Barack Obama and the Democrats are going out there on a big gamble, and that they are rushing this.
Now, we've heard, of course, and President Obama has pointed to this, as Senator DeMint saying, that if we can stop health care reform, we can stop this president. So there's a lot of political nature riding on this.
Yeah, and, you know, this is unfortunate, I think, for a number of reasons. And the chief one is that all these members of Congress are going to be going home in August for their August recess. And their constituents are going to have a lot of very specific questions. You know, whose taxes are going to get raised for this? What kind of responsibilities will employers have for providing health care for their workers? Is this thing going to have a public plan, an option for a government-run health care system essentially to run alongside the private one? They're going to have very specific questions. And right now, it really does look like this whole debate is turning into one of these typical Washington, you know, finger-pointing and name-calling festivals.
Again, Karen Tumulty is national political correspondent for Time magazine. We'll come back to her in a moment. First, here's Mark Goldwine. He's policy director for the Nonpartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Mark Goldwine, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
You're one who has emphasized this question of costs. What problems do you see at the moment?
Well, the healthcare system as a whole is spiraling out of control. In the United States, we have higher costs than any other country in the world by far, without really any measurably better health outcomes. And our costs are growing well faster than the economy. And over time, in our current course, this has implications not only for businesses and for workers, but also for the government, because we pay about a third to half of all healthcare costs, and especially in Medicare and Medicaid. Those programs are growing faster than we can possibly afford to pay for them.
So if we have the highest cost in the world and no better outcomes than anybody else, I would assume you think we ought to have some kind of reform.
Oh, absolutely. We need to have serious health care reform in order to get our costs under control and at least slow the growth from its current track.
So the question then is, how do you cut costs and still maintain good quality?
Yeah, it's tough. There are studies out there that show that as much of a third of healthcare spending as what they call little or no value to overall health outcomes. So there's definitely waste out there. We're conducting extra tests. We're doing procedures that aren't necessary. Sometimes we're over-treating people to the point we're actually hurting them rather than helping them. So we need to find a way to cut out some of that waste and bad spending, but it's not a free lunch, because it's hard to cut out the bad stuff without cutting up some of the good stuff. So it's going to be tough.
How much of that one-third that has no immediate medical benefit is due to insurance company overhead?
Well, there's certainly a bigger insurance problem in the United States than in other countries, because we have a more private and fragmented system. Medicare and Medicaid, I don't want to say it's free lunches, though. They have a lot of waste and fraud as well, and they're treating patients with higher costs. So it's not – the administrative argument isn't as large as some of the people make it out to be. But there's certainly profit-seeking and rent-seeking and a lot of administrative costs among insurance companies. We really need to reform, among other things, insurance markets and the way they compete with each other to wring a lot of that out.
Mark Goldwine, once again, with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Back to Karen Tumulty with Time magazine. Are these the major kinds of arguments that are being made against what's been proposed and passed by the committees so far? What other things are being added?
Well, I think, you know, there are some real ideological flashpoints. You know, what should this public option, this government-run option, look like? Who should have access to it? You know, the thing about healthcare reform is that the debate takes place on so many levels. Last weekend, for instance, the governors revolted over one provision that would drastically one way of expanding coverage would be to drastically expand Medicaid, which is something that shows up on their books. There's a big fight over whether things like abortion ought to be included in the benefits package. Essentially, there's everywhere you turn, there's a different fight going on.
Mark Goldwine, what's your thought with regard to Medicaid? Do you agree with the governors?
Well, certainly expanding Medicaid without the federal government paying for it would increase state costs. There's no question there. But ultimately, any plan to expand coverage is going to cost money, and we need to make decisions about who should be paying for it. Do we want to cut other Medicare and Medicaid spending? Do we want to raise taxes? Do we want the states to face some of the burden? It may have to be all three.
Karen Tumulty, one of the phrases, slogans that's been tossed around in the debate, particularly on the Internet, is Obamacare. Is there such a thing as Obamacare? You said that there have been bills of a different nature passed by committees of Congress. Does the president himself have a plan? Has he endorsed any one or all of these?
Well, he had one during the presidential campaign, but his philosophy, his approach to this whole debate has been essentially to try and do the opposite of what Bill and Hillary Clinton did. He is trying to let Congress do its work, write its bills, and, you know, he says, I'll come in at the end and weigh in. That was a strategy that was working quite well until quite recently. Now, it seems like every member of Congress I talk to is saying, we need the president to get more specific about what he will and will not accept in this final bill. And in part because these guys are all going to be going home for the August recess, and they aren't going to be able to answer any of these specific questions from their constituents, like who's going to pay the tax bill, because they don't have those answers. And certainly I think at this point they would like to see the president be a lot more explicit about what a final bill should look like.
The White House is saying today that the president tonight will answer the questions that the American people want answered. Presumably that's an attempt to address what you're saying.
Yeah, we'll see if that's the case. I mean, certainly the people I've talked to on Capitol Hill today are not, their hopes for this are not terribly high.
John Goodman is the president of the National Center for Policy Analysis. He advises Republicans on health care issues. And John Goodman, it's good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Sometimes Democrats as well, by the way.
Democrats too. Okay. But at the moment, Republicans, how are the Republicans doing in terms of their opposition to the president and to the idea of health care reform as passed out by Democrats in the committees of Congress?
Well, they're in complete disarray. They have no plan that they've been able to unite behind. There is a bill endorsed by Senator Coburn and Representative Paul Ryan. It's a very good bill, but it does not have even a majority of Republicans behind it. So they are they've become unimportant. All the disagreements are among Democrats at the moment. And what Republicans should be saying is that we're about to nationalize the health care system without solving any major problem. We're not going to bring down costs. We're not going to improve quality. And we may not even improve access to care. It's not clear in Massachusetts that access to care has actually gone up.
Massachusetts is the model?
Massachusetts is the model for all of the Democratic bills in the Congress.
When you say nationalize, isn't it already nationalized to a great extent? We just heard a conversation about Medicare and Medicaid.
Well, the federal government has a lot of control over both of those, but basically the private sector has its own insurance plans. Employers choose their own plans. What happens in several of these bills that we're looking at is that you won't be able to have a private insurance plan that you and your employer agree to. The federal government will be involved. It will say what qualifies and what doesn't qualify.
The president says, contrary to that, that if you like the plan you have now, you won't have to give it up.
He should never have said that, because what we're about to do is erect a system in which there will be huge incentives for people to, for employers to drop their private coverage and send their employees over to a health insurance exchange that will be created and regulated by government. The subsidies in that exchange will be far higher than the tax subsidies for current employer-provided insurance. And so millions of people will lose their current coverage.
But you say the Republicans aren't doing a good job of making this case.
No, they're not, and they have no positive plan of their own.
Matt Miller is senior fellow for the Center for American Progress. He's author of a book, The Tyranny of Dead Ideas. He also hosts Left, Right, and Center radio program on NPR stations. Served as a budget official under the Clinton during the Clinton administration when the last health care reform effort failed. And Matt Miller, I have to say, he's a colleague of mine at KCRW Radio in Santa Monica. It's good to have you on our program.
Glad to be here, Warren.
What do you say to what we have just heard, that this is going to nationalize health care and set up exchanges that would effectively provide incentives for people to get out of the private system altogether?
Well, I think that's all overheated rhetoric. And I think the
the big picture you have to remember is we all agree that we should do something about 50 million uninsured, which is rising, and that health care costs are out of control. And the Massachusetts plan, contrary to what John was saying, is actually a bipartisan model. Mitt Romney, who was then the governor of Massachusetts, Ted Kennedy, obviously the liberal lion from the Senate, helped encourage Democrats to work to pass that plan. And Massachusetts has now shrunk its the rolls of its uninsured down to the lowest of any state in the country, about 2.5%. And it is the model to have competing an exchange of competing private insurers with subsidies to low-income folks to be able to, for the first time, get access to group coverage outside the employment setting. That's the major breakthrough that Obama and Congress and Republicans also should want to support, because today the system in which no one can get access to group rates outside an employer setting ends up sort of dooming millions of Americans and locking folks into jobs, burdening business with costs that it shouldn't have in a 21st century global economy. And even though the process, as Karen and your other guests have pointed out, look, the politics are Byzantine and very difficult, but there is a chance to make a breakthrough on this that'll really serve the country well.
Hasn't former Governor Romney himself repudiated the plan? Is it still bipartisan, if that's the case?
Yeah, I think Governor Romney, responding to his own political imperatives during, you know, for his Republican presidential candidacy, didn't like to be the Republican who worked with Ted Kennedy to pass universal health coverage. But the truth is, he deserves credit for having done that, and it did actually show a model that builds on what other countries do, like Switzerland or Holland, which is to have a universal coverage with private insurers in ways that both sides in the U.S. could come to agree on.
And Karen Tumulty, back to you with Time Magazine. You couldn't have a better example of the Byzantine nature of the politics than that. The plan the Democrats are using is one, and calling it bipartisan, is one that the man who signed it into law has repudiated.
Well, I did a long story on this during the campaign. He has not repudiated it for Massachusetts, but he says it's not a national model. And there are some problems that have shown up in Massachusetts that I think they are trying to figure out how to deal with in a national model. One big problem is that costs have really been soaring in Massachusetts, and this has become a big burden on the state government. The second problem is, when you get all these new people into the system and give them health care, as you know, you can argue morally and economically we should, you need to have health care providers for them. And Massachusetts has a very, very severe shortage of primary care health care providers. So these are the other parts of the system that you really have to deal with.
All right. Once again, enormously complex system. Karen Tumulty with Time Magazine, you're going to leave us. Thanks very much for having been with us as long as you have.
Thanks a lot, Warren.
We'll be back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Once again, President Obama appears to want action in both houses of Congress before the August recess. We'll see it tonight at his news conference if he's still pushing for that. We heard earlier from Karen Tumulty that's simply not going to happen, in part because the Democrats are hung up on it. Here's Michael Steele, who's chairman of the Republican National Committee.
We want to fundamentally reorient 1/6 of our economy in 2 weeks. And that makes no logical sense to me.
Back to John Goodman with the National Center for Policy Analysis, advises some Democrats and Republicans on health care issues. Is the Republican Party in danger if, in fact, no reform takes place, of being seen as the party that killed something that everybody says they want?
I suppose there's some danger in that. I would be happier if they had some positive ideas. Matt Miller had a great article in the New York Times this morning with some good ideas. But on the other hand, where Republicans will be strong is in pointing out that we're about to impose huge new taxes on the private sector when we're in the deepest recession we've been in decades, that, as the Congressional Budget Office says, almost certainly as a result of this bill, workers will lose jobs and they'll have less take-home pay. Hardly the thing you want to do when you're in a deep, deep recession. So Republicans will walk away with some debating points, but I'd rather see them solve the problem.
What are the taxes that you're talking about?
We're taxing capital and labor. And in the House bill, if you don't provide health insurance, the employer has to pay an 8% payroll tax, and there's another 2.5% that comes from the worker. And the alternative to that is to buy insurance, which will probably cost for a family $12,000 or more. And so whether the company is forced to provide the health insurance or whether they start paying those taxes, it makes hiring workers really unattractive, and that's what you don't want to do when you're in the middle of this kind of recession.
Mark Goldwine, back to you with the Nonpartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Would those taxes be offset by savings in the long run, if not immediately?
Well, I think that's the hope. I think the hope is, one, you get what you pay for. So if we want something, we need to pay for it. We want healthcare to also reduce long-term costs. And then so over the very long term, we can have a cheaper healthcare system. That's not going to happen in the short run. That's certainly not going to happen over the next 5-10 years. So we need to find sort of very specific taxes to increase and very specific spending to cut so that we can actually pay for this over the next decade, 2 decades. And then hopefully we can get the system under control and bring costs down.
Matt Miller, back to you with the Center for American Progress, host of Left, Right, and Center on public radio. No good idea is allowed to slip away on this program, and John Goodman says you have some. What were they that you wrote about today in the New York Times?
Well, the basic argument was that to save health care reform, we should cut Congress's benefits. And the logic is, you know, everyone who wants universal coverage, including me, you find irresistible the rallying cry, you know, everyone should have the same health benefits of a member of Congress, because who can disagree with that? The problem is Congress's plan is actually quite rich, and it doesn't have any of the kind of incentives that more innovative new ideas and plans are actually doing to, in a fair way, give the consumer a stake in, you know, trying to understand what health care costs, and thus, you know, setting up a system that forces providers to compete on better value. And so expanding the congressional plan to 50 million uninsured and maybe to everybody requires, you know, much higher levels of tax hikes and spending. If you could just give Congress a more cost-effective plan and use that as the model for the country, you could cover the entire country in a more cost-effective way that would actually set in motion these incentives that would do a better job. And so it harnesses some of the ideas that John and others who are conservative tend to argue, which is to use health savings accounts, sort of tax-sheltered accounts, through which people could put aside money to pay for particularly their primary and preventive care and also build up savings for other medical expenses, but to do it in a fair way that also limited the out-of-pocket maximum exposure as a percent of income that low-income people in particular would face, because it doesn't do any good for a poor person to have catastrophic health coverage with a $5,000 deductible if they're earning $20,000 a year. $5,000 is still, you know, a devastating thing for them. But if you found the right percentage of income to limit everybody's exposure to and still have some of those incentives and fund those people who need help to cover their preventive and primary care, you should have a blend of liberal and conservative thinking that would make progress. It's just very hard for that to find political expression in the current environment.
Has the president managed to have the best of both liberal and conservative thinking?
I don't think so yet, but I think that the way I view this process is the main difference between now and when we blew it in 1994, when I was working for President Clinton in the White House, is, remember, under the Clinton health care plan, it never even got to a vote in the Congress. So you have to remember, Obama's main objective is basically the basics of how a bill becomes a law. Something has to pass the House, something has to pass the Senate, and then everything depends on what happens in the conference committee between the two houses. That's where the real deal is going to get struck. My hope is that on the Senate side, there will be a chance, I'm still hoping, that some Republicans on the Senate Finance Committee will join with Max Baucus and the Democrats to have a more economically rational yet progressive package that can come out of that chamber, go to conference, and then Obama and the White House will weigh in a way that makes a final package something that does bring together the best of both sides. That's my hope.
Matt Miller with the Center for American Progress. John Goodman said that sounded good to him. Mark Goldwine, back to you with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Do you agree those are good ideas?
Yeah, I think that you really need to focus on getting the incentives under control. And President Obama and both houses, Democrats of both houses, have been really good on the supply side, or they've been okay on the supply side, looking at how to fix provider payments to an extent. They haven't done anything on the demand side, which I think is what Mike is talking about. How do we get individuals and how do we get businesses to shop around for cheaper insurance, to shop around for cheaper health care, and to make better decisions about when certain procedures and medications are worth the cost and when they aren't.
Well, Matt Miller just talked about cutting benefits to the congressional program, and there are those who say that any effort to really reform health care and to reduce costs particularly will result in a kind of rationing. Here again is Michael Steele, the chair of the Republican National Committee.
Well, if my 85-year-old grandmother wants a hip replacement, why should we replace her hip? Well, who wants to have that conversation with the 85-year-old grandmother? Do you? Do you want to be the one to tell her you can't because you're too old? Do you want me to tell her that? Do you want the federal government to tell her that? That's a personal decision, and the government should not put itself in the position of dictating to anyone what their health care outcomes are.
Back to John Goodman with the Center for Policy Analysis. If you're advising Republicans, is that a good argument?
Well, I think that's the way we're going, and if you listen carefully, as the mainstream media has not done, to what President Obama has said and Peter Orszag and Zeke Emanuel, they are talking about changing the way doctors practice medicine. They're talking about doing less, fewer tests, fewer procedures, and there's no way you can force that without causing harm to patients if you try to do it from the demand side of the market, which is the total way they're going to approach it. So I think we are going to have rationing, and we are going to have problems, and I don't know what the extent of it is going to be, but it's definitely something to worry about.
Don't we already have rationing based on cost?
Well, we don't have the kind of rationing we're about to have. Pretty much people get whatever they want, and someone else pays for it in this country. Even uninsured get a lot of what they want, and someone else pays for it. We don't do what they do in Britain or in Canada. In Britain, they have a commission that decides whether procedures are worth their cost, and the rule of thumb there is they don't want to spend more than $22,000 a year, for example, on cancer drugs to save 6 months of life. Well, I don't think we're going to do that tomorrow in the United States, but those are the kinds of decisions I think we're going to be facing.
Mark Goldwein, back to you. Are those decisions inevitable?
I think they are, because ultimately costs can't continue to grow on their current path. Rationing is sometimes thrown out as a bad word, and of course nobody wants somebody else telling them what they can afford. But we have to remember the government, in Michael Steele's case, is the one paying for this hip replacement. We should start by trying to get people to not purchase the things that we know, to stop using the healthcare that we know doesn't really add much medical benefit. But I think we are going down the path where it's going to be harder and harder to get certain types of procedures.
So, Matt Miller, back to you. If this is inevitable, isn't this what makes it so very, very difficult to politically when you ultimately get down to the kinds of decisions that are going to have to be made?
I mean, the rationing charge, I think, is sort of the standard political scare tactic, to which I understand why, you know, Republicans are using it at this moment. But everybody knows that there is radical inefficiency in the U.S. healthcare system. We spend 17% of GDP. Every other advanced nation spends 10 or 11%. They cover everybody. They have health outcomes that are as good or better. And we have these huge regional variations in the way, in the intensity of procedures and tests and utilization that that Republican analysts and Democratic analysts will agree is evidence of huge inefficiency. The only way you can begin to get at that is to have some kind of benchmarks for what effective best practices are. And when the Republicans are against even the research on that, which is what they've been sort of fighting, you know it's more about politics than about the substance of where we need to go, because even thoughtful Republican healthcare analysts say that we've got to find ways to make the system more efficient. The political problem is always that every dollar of healthcare waste, in quotes, is somebody's dollar of income. That's why reform is so hard. But we have to set in motion some kind of forces of consumer and value and competition based on delivering healthcare value that something like these exchanges that are being talked about could set up in a way that once we get past some of the politics, both sides could support.
John Goodman, once again, it would appear that nothing's going to happen before the August recess. They're not going to have bills in either House. So all of the senators and Congress members will presumably go back to their districts. What's going on there? I know you've referred to something called trench warfare going on outside Washington. What is it? What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, President Obama is emailing his supporters, I think 18 million of them, every week, and I see his emails. And at the National Center for Policy Analysis, we now have about 620,000 people who've signed a petition for us on the other side, and we email them. And The mainstream media has just ignored these messages. But just to go back to what Matt said, there is a lot of variation in the way medicine is practiced across the country. The same thing's true in Canada. Same thing's true in every country. And you cannot solve these problems from the demand side of the market. The only way to get efficient medicine is to liberate the supply side. And nobody in Washington is thinking that way. Nobody's talking about it. But that's the kind of innovative reform Republicans ought to be thinking about.
Well, what are the messages that the mainstream media are ignoring?
Oh, what they've ignored is that they're on talk radio and over the Internet, there is a big debate going on. And they're talking about rationing, and they're talking about the exchanges, and they're talking about the new taxes, and they're talking about everything. Mainstream media is totally focused on Washington. When these guys go back home, they're going to confront voters who have a totally different perspective on all of this.
Is this a more honest debate, are you suggesting, than is going on in Washington?
Oh, yes. When ordinary people talk to each other, it's always more honest than what happens in Washington.
I think we could probably all assent to that. But Matt Miller, what do you say to that? Is Washington, is the mainstream media, are the mainstream media focused on the wrong things?
Look, these are very complicated issues, and it's just a fact that in our political and media culture, both sides end up finding kind of cardboard versions of their values to try and communicate. And it makes it very hard if you're not sort of digging in, you know, on the Internet or reading a lot more to understand some of the true stakes of this debate. But again, the big picture is still we shouldn't have a system where 50 million people and more are uncovered. We're in a recession like the one we're in now because of the unique employer-based healthcare system that we have. When unemployment rises, literally millions of people have lost their health coverage in this recession, and they don't have the ability to, if they've got any pre-existing conditions, to get coverage in the individual market alone. These are problems that a wealthy nation like ours should not tolerate, and there is a way to fix these things. Even though the politics are complex, that we should be able to see our way through this year.
John Goodman, back to you again. You're advising Republicans. Is the president doing a better job than the Republicans of handling this issue?
Oh, he's doing a much better job. His problem is he doesn't have the right solutions. And the left wing of the Democratic Party does not understand incentives the way we've been talking about them here today. And so their favored reforms involve giving everyone perverse incentives, and it makes the problem worse. And so when their Congressional Budget Office comes in and says costs aren't going to go down, they're going to go up, they're all shocked. And that's the problems they are having. Republicans probably should just shut up and let the process go forward because who knows? Maybe the Democrats will wise up to the fact that incentives really matter and that to have workable reform, you've got to get the incentives right.
Mark Goldbein, back to you. Do you think the president is handling this well?
You know, I'm not ready to count out this administration or this Congress, but certainly there are problems ahead. Certainly the House has put together a bill that doesn't do all the things that they wanted. And I think sometimes the best policies are the worst politics. For example, almost every economist agrees we should be taxing employer health insurance the same way we tax wages. But that's pretty much off the table in the policy world. And I think we're seeing a lot of that, and it's causing a lot of problems with what the legislations look like.
Matt Miller, you were once again in the Clinton White House when HillaryCare, as it came to be called, failed. Is this president doing better? Is he more likely to succeed?
He's doing much better precisely because he is letting Congress, he's working with Congress to get things passed. Again, you got to have something pass the House, even though it's imperfect. There's a lot I don't like. I mean, I agree with the critique. We shouldn't put 8% payroll taxes on small businesses to fund health care. I don't think we should be trying to cling to employer-based health coverage at all. We're the only country that does. It's bad for business. It's bad for individuals who only get coverage if they're with a major employer. But again, even with its imperfections, Obama's the macro vision is get something passed on both sides, try and get some bipartisan stuff out of the Senate, and then go to conference. And I think the difficulty is that the great thing that Obama chose to do that the Clintons, in retrospect, you know, would not have done the same way, was they had a so-called Clinton health care plan that was 1,200 pages out there for months and months and months being torn apart by every interest group. And that happens invariably in these healthcare debates because so much money is at stake. Obama has gotten the different stakeholders at the table, the insurers, the health plans, the pharmaceutical folks, all the industry stakeholders, the consumer groups, and he's tried to have a process where we get something passed and then we try and work out a deal in conference. So I think he's doing as good as you could possibly do, given the inherent difficulties in the American political system
but
something this ambitious.
But back to the Clintons, the failure for them was, and for the president, was very significant. What are the risks of failure for President Obama?
Well, they're huge, obviously. Anytime a president stakes so much of his prestige and political capital on a major initiative, the risks are obviously huge, but President Obama should be admired for that. It's a major problem that the country faces, and he's trying to do something very serious about it. That takes risk.
And once again, John Goodman, asked you this question before, but it's worth, it seems to me, repeating. If it fails, what are the prospects that the Republicans will get tagged with a defeat and everybody will be very disappointed in them?
Well, there's a risk of that, but again, if it gets defeated, it will get defeated, I think, because of the economics of it. A $12,000 family health insurance policy works out to about $6 or more per hour for workers, and nobody's explained how it is that all these employers are going to provide that kind of insurance coverage to people earning near the minimum wage. And lots of people are in danger of losing their jobs, or they're in danger of having huge reductions in take-home pay. And once the reality of that dawns on everyone, I think it's going to be really hard to pass this kind of legislation.
Mark Goldwine, are we in the next 15 years going to be debating this very same issue?
I hope not.
Let's leave it at that. Mark Goldwine, again, is a policy director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Says it's nonpartisan. John Goodman is president of the National Center for Policy Analysis. Says he advises some Democrats, but mostly Republicans. Matt Miller is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, author of The Tyranny of Dead Ideas, and the host of Left, Right, and Center on Public Radio. Thanks, all of you, very much for being with us today. Last week, the New York Yankees canceled a signed deal with a hot young prospect from the Dominican Republic. Evidence showed he had misrepresented his identity. The evidence came from a DNA test, but such tests may be illegal under federal law starting this coming November. More in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Just last year, President Bush signed into law a prohibition on companies testing the DNA of their employees. It'll take effect on November 21st of this year. Major League Baseball has told the New York Times that teams have been conducting such testing for years. Sports writer Michael S. Schmidt co-wrote the story. And Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, why do the teams do this?
Well, teams have lost a lot of money in the Dominican Republic on prospects who say that they're younger than they really are. They give them very lucrative contracts because they think that they're, say, 16-year-olds that have the skills of 19-year-olds. But then it turns out that they're really 19.
What difference does that make, just 3 years?
Well, it's like, you know, if you have a seventh grader reading at a seventh grade reading level, you know, that's sort of normal. But if you have a fourth grader reading at a seventh grade reading level, that's a big difference.
And for baseball, there's money on that because obviously the player might have a longer career.
Correct. You know, and it also shows a certain development in their skills. They've given players that they thought were 16 huge contracts and then had to deal with the disclosure later that they're a lot older and that they don't want to lose any more money on this.
How does DNA testing give you the correct age of a player?
Well, it's not just taking the DNA of the player that gives the age. The big problem they have is players taking on identities that are not their own, identities of people that are younger with them. So to verify their identities, baseball asks the player for their DNA and asks their parents for their DNA, and to verify that their parents are who they say they are.
So in other words, the players get people to say, oh, yeah, that's my son, and he's really only 16?
Yeah, they take on different identities. They take on the identity of, you know, someone 3 years younger that has a certain parents on their birth certificate, and they go and find those parents and test to see if they really are their parents.
How often does this happen, and how often have the DNA tests been conducted?
It's unclear. Baseball said that it's used sparingly and has not been used a lot. Teams are believed to have done this for several years, but the league is believed to have begun it only in the past few months.
What about this federal law that will take effect on November 21st? Will this prevent them from doing it?
Well, it's unclear. Because it's an American corporation operating outside the United States, it's a little gray. The biggest thing here is that the act hasn't gone into effect yet, so it hasn't really been enforced. But it does say that an American-based company, regardless of whether the employee is an American citizen, cannot ask for DNA, period, or ask a family member for DNA.
Well, one of the reasons is to protect people's privacy and to protect decisions to be made based on such things as what sort of a disease they might be subject to later in life. That would certainly be interesting to baseball teams, one would assume. What are the potential consequences for that in the sport?
Well, I think the fear of any employer getting their hands on the DNA of the employee is what they could learn. They could see what diseases they're predisposed to. They could see what, you know, a lot of things into who they are. And I think that the public feels that the employer should not have that information and be able to use it to discriminate and to pay and compensate, hire and fire.
There's a real irony here because one of the greatest players of all time gave his name to a genetic disease. That's Lou Gehrig.
Yeah, as one of the experts that we quoted today pointed out, if a team had known that Lou Gehrig was predisposed to such a disease, would they have signed him?
Are there incidents where players have, in fact, moved into baseball based on false IDs, become stars, and then faded away or have so that the team has suffered the consequences of their misrepresentation?
Well, Miguel Tejada, last year, it was revealed that he was several years older than he said he was, and he's been in the majors for over a decade, has won an MVP, has played for a handful of teams. So that was a very present example. After 9/11, when there was a crackdown on documentation and immigration, the cases came out then. And there's been, you know, other players along the way who they're just not sure how old they are, you know.
If they are found to have misrepresented themselves, is that grounds for just canceling the contract?
No. It has no player that I know of has had their contract canceled because of that.
So, what about, let's go a little bit beyond baseball and into the reasons for the law. And the concerns that genetic and bioethical professionals have about this. Elaborate a bit on this.
Well, when GINA went into effect, it was basically to prevent the employer from getting their hands on this type of information and turning our society, I guess, into a place where our genetic information had a direct, you know, impact on our fate and status and how employers could look at us and how insurance companies could look at us and whether insurance companies could discriminate against certain people because they would cost the insurance company more money because they were more likely to have disease. So the people that worked to get GINA passed believed that there was a slippery slope and that if you let an employer take any type of DNA, then who really knows what happens with that information? And who knows if it really is disposed of property or if not, if the employer is holding on to it to use later to find out more about the employee.
So this is one of the first instances, really, that's come up since that law was passed. Major League Baseball is sort of the canary in the coal mine.
Well, I'm sure that since the law has been passed, an employer besides Major League Baseball has taken the DNA of an employee, but this is the first. Experts say they believe this is one of the first ones since the law was passed that they've done this.
Another thing that helps to determine age is bone scans. Do they also conduct bone scans? They wouldn't have the same kind of problems associated with them.
They do, but I think that bone scans are only tell part of the story, and I think that DNA only tells part of the story. because there's, you know, you're only, you can only catch so many of them through the identity checking and through the bone scans. There's only so many that you can catch. So there's a sort of a multi-pronged effort by baseball, who believes that they're just trying to protect themselves.
All right, and it's kind of a new wrinkle in the baseball scouting as well. Michael Schmitz, it's good to have you on our program, and thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Sports reporter for the New York Times. Today's program produced by Gary Scott with Christian Bordahl and Rebecca Mooney. Our technical director is Mike Newport. The managing producer, Cameron Radziner. You can email us or you can share your thoughts on our comment page. That's kcrw.com/To The Point. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.